So we'll ask Mr. Snowblind forward to speak to us on his subject, Who is Your God?
Thanks, Peter. The title of our presentation tonight is obviously a question, and it is by very nature a personal question. And I suppose it's a question that we generally don't like to be asked, and there are many reasons we don't like to be asked this question. I think partly because it's sometimes embarrassing. It sometimes is very hard for us to have to process that information and answer that question to determine exactly who our God is. And then some of us might say, I know who my God is, and some of us have been going to Sunday school or been raised in Christian families since we were young, and we have a fairly good idea, we think, about what the answer to that question is. Well, I think the problem is it's not quite that simple. And tonight I'd like to take you through a thought process to try and examine what the answer perhaps is and what the answer should be. Now, first of all, when we say, who is your God, we don't really have any alternative but to point the finger and say, well, and this isn't about being rude and pointing the finger. It is about saying that the answer to the question about who is your God is found in us. Because when we think about it, we realize that practically everything that we worship, and there are many things that we worship, pretty much revolve around our thinking in our inner selves. So we don't make any apology for saying that the subject and this question, who is your God, is about us. We make our own gods one way or the other. We decide who our gods are going to be. Now, we might say, well, there's lots of other gods that are made, and we'll discuss that in a bit. But we have the option. We have the choice of whether we worship them. So, again, it's not just that simple. Now, against that, we may know, too, that in the Hebrew Christian Bible, one of the commandments, the first commandment, and related to the first commandment, is this statement, that you shall have no other gods before me. So then it states quite clearly that there is a human problem that we actually have many gods. And that's what we would like to kind of explore a little bit more tonight. I'm going to start off by using this term alter ego, and I think probably most of us understand what that is. We generally have a picture or an image of ourselves, of what we want to be or what we think we should look like or what we think is expected of us to look like. And we're busy usually working on that one way or the other. Now, I know we may be in denial and say, no, that's not true. But most of us have some idea of what we would like to be, what we imagine ourselves to be, and so on. I would like to present you with four words that I think help to define what we're talking about when we talk about our alter ego, especially in the day in which we live. And these words are possessing, providing, performing, and progressing. And if we took our lives today, I think we could find a definition to how we think and how we live within these four words. And probably how we define our lives and what we look like by looking at these four words. Now, possessing is, again, I think pretty obvious. We live in a day and age where we possess all kinds of things, all kinds of stuff. And I had one of my nephews visiting some time ago, and they just bought a new house. And they just moved out of their old house, and he said, I want to see your garage. Now, he was only, I don't know, 5 or 6. I want to see your garage. And I said, why do you want to see my garage? It's kind of, no, I want to see your garage. So he went down to look in our garage. There's nothing in it. Well, except a car, which is all you should have in a garage. And I said, well, so do you have a garage? And he says, yeah, we have a garage. And I said to him, what is it full of? What's in it? And he said, stuff. Well, what does that mean? Just stuff, he said, full of, in the garage. So I think that defines what we are. And now, my mother, as some of you will know, just fell asleep in Christ about a month ago. She had no stuff. And I say this in sort of contrast to what we often see in life today. In fact, she had so little stuff that when we said to the family, come and get it, nobody showed up. There was nothing that anybody wanted. And there was a bit of a joke in the family that we don't have to bother locking Mother's house because she's got nothing to steal. And in a way, that's the other side of this. The old idea of saying, well, I don't need stuff. I can get by in what I've got. Now, a few years ago, I think it was sort of in the beginning of the 90s, I had a business associate who were working on a project with down in Oak Bay on, I think it was Victoria Avenue, and he had, among other things, a Bentley and a Hummer. Now, most of you probably don't know what a Hummer is, but in the early 90s, the Hummer was the biggest, most ostentatious sport utility vehicle that money could buy. Now, this Hummer was not just a normal Hummer. This is what we would call a tricked-out Hummer. It was metallic black. It was loaded with chrome, leather seats. And we were going down to the site one day, and inadvertently, he just drove by me. He passed me. So I wanted to make sure we were going to rendezvous at the same place, so I called him on my phone. This was in the days before, you know, hands-free was an issue. So I called him on my phone. He answered the phone. He starts talking to me on his phone, and we were chatting away, talking about what we were going to do and where we were going. He suddenly said to me, Clyde, just a minute, hold the line. My other phone is ringing. His other phone is ringing. That really bothered me, right, because I only had one phone. In fact, it bothered me so much that for years this became kind of my definition of possessing and about what we needed or didn't need in this whole materialistic world in which we live. My other phone is ringing. Now, of course, I now have two phones in my truck. And one of them is a satellite phone. Now, you never had a satellite phone, but I have a satellite phone and leather seats. Now, the fact is, friends, that there's no end to this, you know, in terms of, well, I guess there would be an end in terms of what we couldn't afford, so that would be the end to it. Jesus said quite clearly, watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. So that can be our definition of ourself and the possessions that we have, or the lack of possessions that we have in relation to other people who have more possessions. I didn't have a Bentley or a Hummer. So that gives you some cause for thought. So my summation of the materialistic society, possessing, that is the source and the basis of worship and therefore can be our God. Providing. Well, providing is a huge problem today because providing is not only possessions, but it is providing possessions in terms of an accepted standard of living or some type of relative idea with other people about what we should have. Not that we really need all of these things, but there's kind of a comparative value. And so we can spend an awful lot of energy and an awful lot of time trying to provide. Generally, it's for our family, maybe it's our friends, we put huge effort into that. So you can see how that providing itself becomes kind of an obsession and part of this alter ego that we have. And providing actually is easily followed by performing, because we get very stressed out very often if we can't perform like we should to provide more possessions. And performance is complicated today because there's so many things that we do and so many choices that we have to make, so many places to go. And not only that, but performing comes down to what we can get done in a day. And the faster we can do things, the more things we have to do, the more possibilities we have, the more stressed out we get because of all of these things that we do. So performing becomes part of this definition of what we are. And my dentist is down in Oak Bay. She's got an office down by the Oak Bay Beach Hotel. And I used to be able to get there from where we are in 27 minutes. It now takes over 45 minutes to get there. That's because there's far more cars on the road. That's because there's far more issues along the way. There's far more schools and school zones, and left turns are take longer to do. And to get to there from where I am, I've got to make a whole bunch of left turns. And so it takes more time. And so performing is an issue because you only have so many hours in a day. And performing, especially on the road, and I don't think there's any better place to judge the angst of this, is in sort of the margins of road rage. And you're all probably sitting there, oh, no, I don't do that. I'm very patient. But there is anxiety. Possessing, providing, performing, and progressing. Because all of this has to mean that we're getting better and we're doing more stuff and we're making some progress. Jesus told the story of a guy who had barns and he had a big crop. So he tore his barns down and built bigger ones. That's progress, bigger barns. And that's when he said, by the way, this quote from Luke chapter 12, verse 15 that I've already mentioned. Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed, and man's life doesn't consist of possessing and providing and performing and so on, and building bigger barns. You know, we called it two-footitis when we had boats years ago, because you had a 14-foot boat and then a 16-foot boat and an 18 and a 24. So we did that with boats. That was progressing. You don't have the same boat, you have a bigger boat. Is that right? Many people do it with homes. It's not two-footitis, it's square-footitis, probably. Because, and we do it because we can, a lot of the time. Because we have choices. And because it's fun, and because it feeds into this alter ego that we have, and this sort of God that we worship. What will we do next? Where does it end? Now, of course, none of this will save us. When we stop to think about it, none of this will save us. It's a false God. But it is, however, the God that most people worship and are enslaved to. Who is your God? Is your other phone ringing? This is a nasty one here, because in Philippians chapter, I'm going to get this sorted out here right now. Philippians chapter 3, verse 19, and we're going to come back to this a little bit later, God willing. The writer, Paul, writing to the church at Philippi, says, speaking about people who are into this kind of material pursuit of another God, says their end is destruction. Their God is their belly. Now, if in answering this question, we said, who is your God? And you said, oh, my God is my belly. And you might say, it looks like it too, right? But the fact is that belly, in a way, is representative of everything that we consume and the basic instinct that we have to consume. These basic instincts that we have are summarized and turned into a metaphor by the term belly, consumption. And because it's also involving setting their minds on earthly things. So if we set our minds on earthly things, what better focus than our belly? So it's a mental focus. It's about personal glory. It's about other things. It's about consumption. And the Bible tells us that the end of that is destruction. It doesn't go anywhere. Romans chapter 16, verse 18 says, for such persons do not serve our Lord Christ, but their own appetites. And if we said, who is your God? And nobody's probably going to say, my appetite. Nobody's going to say that. That's why it's a subtle thing. It's a difficult subject to really answer. but it is nevertheless true. It's also very much tied into our self-esteem, because that alter ego, that image that we have of ourself, is generally generated by this thing called self-esteem. And self-esteem is defined in many, many different ways in our society. As a matter of fact, we've had a couple of generations of self-esteem. I was born into a generation where that wasn't defined yet, but that has been well defined in the last 40 or 50 years. Don't fix me, I'm not broken. As a matter of fact, I'm great. I had a student once who was a weightlifter, and he told the students one day, the other students, that every morning when he gets up, he stands in front of the mirror and he says, "I'm great." And that was his alter ego. That was his thing. Don't fix him, he wasn't broken. But I think that really is a summation of what we think in terms of self-esteem. Mae West: "I never loved another person the way I love myself." Self-esteem, it's self-love and self-promotion. Now, this is a very challenging problem, because very often, again, we define our self-esteem by the things that we have, the possessions. This quote I find quite interesting. "Aren't fairy godmothers supposed to be nice and make you feel better about yourself?" No, you're confusing fairy godmothers with sales clerks. And so what's happening here is that we develop our God that we worship in our possessions, because and what makes us feel good is the things that we buy. And then, you know, we have a credit card or something, so that if we're feeling a little bit sad, as my grandmother used to say, every time I'm down in the dumps, I go and buy a new hat. And I said, "Well, I wondered where you got them from." But that's what you do. You go out and purchase. You go out and buy. And so you support your self-esteem. So self-esteem is mental. It's how we think about ourselves. And it's also material. It's the things that we buy for ourselves. Now, I'm going to vent my spleen a little bit more for a minute. We're talking about self-esteem in the new world that we live in, because we have to deal with this thing called the resume. And I'm not going to stand up here tonight and tell you how to write a resume, but I do know that there are probably ways that you shouldn't write a resume. We have, I think, retained, we're recruiting all the time in our business. And we have right now, I think, 235 resumes, electronic resumes, that we've kept. And we don't keep them all, because some of them just aren't good fits at all, so we let them go. There's a surprising number of these 235 resumes. A surprising number of them tell us that they demonstrate strong leadership skills. Demonstrate strong leadership skills. Now, again, I don't know really who teaches them how to write resumes, but this is a very dominant theme. Most people that are applying for work want to be leaders. They demonstrate strong work ethics. They're reliable. They're committed to quality work, hardworking, physically fit, motivated, punctual, organized, detail-oriented. They work independently or with minimal supervision. Whatever you want, they've got it. Really, that's what they're saying. Ability to work effectively in a group. I got that one messed up a bit, don't I? Excellent communication skills. Great communication skills. Great attitudes. They adapt well to new situations. They're fast learners. They're able to lift over 50 pounds. Well, that's good, because I'm not. Able to focus on details within larger tasks. To identify details within larger tasks and perform them. Able to follow directions. You'd want to hire this person. Able to maintain the integrity behind the product. Great organizational and time management skills. Excellent problem solving. These, friends, are the words that are common to resume after resume after resume. Now, you have to sit there and go, "Oh, come on," right? is that person really out there? This is really a perplexing problem with resumes. I was talking to a young man at the entrance to a hotel in Victoria a couple of weeks ago, and he was new, and I said, how'd you get the job here? He says, I filled out an online resume, an online application. I said, really, you go online? Yeah, there's a form, you fill it out. Well, what were the type of questions that they asked you? Well, he said, well, you know, there would be a question that's something like this. On a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being poor and 5, and 1 being poor and 5 being excellent, how do you rate your positivity? So I said to him, well, what did you put? He says, me, 5. Well, what else did you have? Well, on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being poor and 5 being excellent, how do you rate your sensitivity? I said, well, what did you put? Me? He said, 5. On a scale of 1 to 5, with 5 being excellent and 1 being poor, how do you rate your ability to work with others? Well, what did you say? 5. Why wouldn't I? Punctuality? 5. Communication skills? Me, 5. And I said, you know, you really did all that? He says, yeah, Clyde, but he says, when I got about halfway through it, I thought, I don't know whether I really want to work with these people. Now, we had a gal who was quite persistent a couple of months ago and said that we would be just amazed at what she could do for our company. And I didn't know really what that meant. But and she had all kinds of leadership skills. And I says, we're not looking for leaders. We're looking for someone to pull weeds. And I never heard back from her. Right? Because that is the big question that we have. Who is going to pull the weeds? Now, I say this because we're getting back to this thing about self-esteem. In the Garden of Eden, I understand there were no weeds. Now, a weed we would define as being a plant where you don't want it to be. In the Garden of Eden, in the garden itself, there were no weeds, thorns or thistles. Now, the fact is that the man and the woman in the garden decided that they wanted to question God, or maybe wanted to put their own sort of alter ego out there and say, well, we're not going to do that and be obedient. We're going to do this. Now, the result of that was, according to the biblical account, they were thrown out of the garden and the land was cursed. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. By the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. Not good at all for self-esteem. And that's the problem that we have when we get down to the basic issue of who is our God and who is God. And what is the relationship between God and man? And mankind has been in conflict, really, with the Creator since that time. This is the great struggle of life. Everybody wants to be a manager. Nobody wants to pull weeds. I'm saying this literally and symbolically as well. We don't want to do what the Creator has asked us to do, and that is to obey. If we obeyed, we'd have to pull a lot of weeds. But we don't want to do that. And that's one of the reasons I suggest that we have issues in our society today. We want to be our own God, we want to be our own, and we want to... Well, that was odd. So we said it's mental, this issue of who is your God, and it's also material. It's mental because sometimes we think that we can just... think our way out of it. We can, by some positive thinking. Now, Job, in the Old Testament, he tried this out, and it didn't work for him. Job chapter 9 and verse 27, he says, because he was in some difficulty with pain and suffering, he says, if I forget my complaint, I'll just change my expression. I'll just put on a happy face. I'll smile. But he said, I still dread my sufferings, because the fact is that there was an underlying reason for suffering, and it didn't just go away and wouldn't just go away by a good, positive mental attitude. The problem, of course, is that within the heart is the issue of pain and suffering, and the heart is a big problem because the Bible tells us that it's deceitful, it's wicked, it's beyond cure. And again, if we say, well, who is our God, and we try and define it ourselves and say, well, I am God, and this is what God is, that is a very depressing proposition, because at the heart of the matter, we have a fundamental problem. So we have self-esteem in mental ways, we have self-esteem in material ways. Now, that chapter that Peter read for us from Romans chapter 1 and verse 22, this is defined, actually, because it says there that we claim to be wise, and this is a broad sweeping statement about all mankind. Claiming to be wise, human beings become fools. They exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So what we do as human beings, we don't want to do what God says, because he says, well, you did that, so you're going to have to pull weeds. And I'm just, again, saying that, metaphorically. But what we do then is we say, okay, well, I'll make myself a god. Which is really going back to our alter image. So this is what I want to be, and this is what I'm going to be, so I'll define myself. And this has been at the root of human worship from the beginning of time. People make images of men and women. They make images of birds and animals and creeping things, snakes and cows and things like that. And then they worship them. Which, I should give you the verse, shouldn't I? This isn't really wise to say, well, what I'll do, I'll worship something that I've made. Because in fact, if you make something, it really has no ability to save you or to help you, really, or to bring about any type of eternal salvation in your life, because you're in control of it. You made it. So we make a swap, basically, in our minds. We say, well, the real true God, I'm going to exchange for something that I make. So therefore, all the things that we possess fall into this category. These are all man-made things. And so we worship them. That's the material part of the image. Now, I'd like you to turn with me to Isaiah chapter 44. To just see how this plays out, because the Old Testament prophets understood this business of making things and then worshiping them, this problem that the human mind has. And we could say, well, who is your God? And nobody here in this room is going to say a block of wood. Nobody's going to give us that answer. But in fact, that is an answer. It's a valid answer. And today we don't quite do this type of thing. We don't, as the prophet says, verse 14, we can start around verse 13 or 14. He goes out into the forest, cuts down a tree. He shapes it. You know, he has tools and stuff, and he shapes it a man, a human form, shapes it into that. And then he forgets the fact that the same tree cut down yesterday for fuel to burn, so he could use that to keep himself warm. Verse 15, he kindles a fire from the same wood, or the remnants of the same tree, and uses it for baking. And then he fashions a god and worships it from the balance of it. So what the prophet is saying is that the man is definitely in control of this whole thing. It's not like the wood has any power. It's the man that has the power. He fashions a god, at the end of verse 15. Half of the wood he burns in the fire and prepares himself his meal, and roasts his meal and eats his fill. And then he warms himself and says, I'm warm. In verse 16, I see the fire. From the rest he makes a god, his idol, and bows down and worships it. Now, if you were kind of the fly on the wall or the gnat in the forest, looking at that, would say, what is that all about? How does that work? And then it says, at the end of verse 17, he bows down to worship it, he prays to it, and says, save me, you are my God. they know nothing. Verse 19, the prophet says, shall I bow down to a block of wood? What sense does that make of anything? I know a number of years ago, Evelyn and I were over in Richmond, and I might have told you this before, that, and there's a big Buddhist temple over there. And we went in there and had a look around and took some pictures. And you're probably saying, what were you doing in a Buddhist temple? You're sightseeing. And there's this big, well, there's a number of Buddhas, actually. It was an amazing thing. There was 40 or 50 Buddhas in there. I'm not trying to make light of the Buddhist religion. I'm just saying that in there, there's 40 or 50 Buddhas. There was a thousand-hand Buddha. There was another sort of Buddha. And there was the biggest Buddha. It was about 30 feet high. And there it was in one of the sort of inner rooms of this temple. What interested me was the fact that over in Richmond, it's all silt. It's all kind of river silt. And this massive temple was sinking. It's all cracking, right? So I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, Buddha's not going to be here long because this whole thing was just coming apart, the whole building. I took a picture of it and put it on my laptop, and I showed my grandson. And so I said, well, what's this? And he made a couple of comments, and I said, what do you think it's made out of? And he said, wood. So does it have eyes? Yes, it has eyes. Well, does it see? No. Oh, it's got ears. Yes, it's got ears. Does it hear? No. And it's got a nose. Do you think it smells? No. And it's got a mouth. Do you think it speaks? No. So the question is, who is your God? It's a valid question, and the prophets of old, as I said, that we've seen here, knew that this was a problem. Human beings want to make stuff, and then they want to worship it. And it's all about the possessing and the providing and the performing and so on. So who is your God? Well, I need to spend a few minutes talking about the God that I want to worship and the God who I want to make my own. Isaiah 57, verse 15, for thus says the one who is high and lifted up. Now, that's a better situation right there for a God, not a block of wood. But this is the contrast, high and lifted up, above me, inhabiting eternity, who's holy, separate. That makes more sense to worship a God who is eternal, who is lifted up above us, and who is holy and separate from us. He says, I dwell in the high and holy place. But here's the big issue. He said, but also with him who is of a contrite and lowly spirit. The God I want to worship is alive and living and eternal and high and lifted up and holy and living in a holy place, who's also prepared to say to me, I also want to live in your heart. In a contrite, lowly heart, to revive it and to fix it. That's the type of God that I want to make my own, and that I want to worship. This is the type of God that I want to make my own, who talks to me, who has eyes who see and a mouth that speaks, and ears that hear, who talks to me. Isaiah 55, verse 1 to 6. Incline your ear and come to me. Hear, that your soul may live. And I will make an everlasting covenant with you. This God that I want to worship wants to make an everlasting covenant with me. And that covenant is in relation to the love that he had for King David of old, where he promised David a kingdom, an eternal kingdom, that would be established on earth in peace and righteousness forever. The God I want to worship is a living God who asks me to seek him, and promises me that I will find him, who asks me to call upon him and has promised that he will respond. That is the God that I want to worship, who is your God. Now, we had this verse before from Philippians chapter 3, verse 20, when Paul, the writer, said, their minds are on earthly things. That was the problem with the stomach being your God, your belly being your God, and the things of the earth. Their minds are on earthly things. And in contrast to that, those who worship the living God have their citizenship in heaven, not in the earth and on the earth with all these possessions and all these things that mankind has been able to make. But our citizenship, he says, is in heaven, and we eagerly await a Savior from there. This is a living, dynamic religion and belief and citizenship that is not this world, but is part of the world to come. And that world is going to come because God, who is eternal, has promised in his covenant that he's going to send the Lord Jesus Christ back to the earth, who, by the power that enables him to bring everything under control, because the God I want to worship is able to do these things and also is able to transform your lowly body and my lowly body so that one day they can be like his glorious body. Who is your God? The earthly things, or is your citizenship in heaven? This is the God that I want to make my own and that I want to worship. This is a remarkable statement of truth about the God of the Bible and the Creator God of heaven. He says, humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 6 to 7, that he may lift you up. God has promised that he'll lift us up. He will fix us and lift us up. We can cast all of our anxiety on him because he cares for us. And you have to go back and contrast that with the block of wood, who can't even care for us and warm us unless we do the chopping and the building of the fire. But this God that I want to make my own cares for me and wants to lift me up. This is the God that I want to worship, who, through his divine power, has given me everything I need for life and godliness. Through the knowledge of him who called us, this God calls us to his glory and to his goodness. This is the God that I want to worship. Who is your God? Isaiah chapter 40, verse 28 begins this last section of Isaiah chapter 40 by saying, do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God. The eternal God of the Bible is everlasting. Why would we want to worship a God that's going to decay? Whose end is destruction. Didn't you know, haven't you heard, that the Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the heavens and the earth? He doesn't grow weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. That's the God that I want to worship. He gives strength to the weary, increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, even though, most of the time they don't want to admit it. Young men actually stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength, mounting up and soaring on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint. The everlasting God, the Creator, is eternal and doesn't grow weary and wants to renew us so that we can soar on wings like eagles. He wants to enable us and literally change us with his eternal energy and spirit. Who is your God? Now, Paul, who wrote this letter to Timothy, made a couple of statements that I'd like to close with. when he said that godliness with contentment is great gain. This is the antidote, really, to the possessing, to the performing, to the providing, to the progressing. Contentment. It's not something that's easy to sell, really. But it is, nevertheless, comes associated with great gain. We didn't bring anything into this world, and we're not going to take anything out. But if we're content and we live godly lives, then the promises of God are for us. Who is your God? Well, if your God is a living God, he outlines the correct path of life for each one of us. We have to flee all of this earthly stuff. The discontent, the possessing, performing, providing, and progressing. Pursue righteousness. That's what we pursue. Godliness, faith, love, endurance, gentleness, fighting the good fight of faith. And if we keep this commandment, he goes on to say in chapter 6 and verse 14, without spot or blame, the Lord is going to appear, Jesus Christ, and God will bring him in his own time. The God who we should worship, the blessed, the only ruler, the King of kings, the Lord of lords, who alone is immortal and who lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see, to him be glory and might forever. That is the God that I want to worship. Who is your God?